This is GamesAtWork.biz with Phaedra Boinodiris, Michael Martin, and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 170, Holographic Whiteboard Penguins. Hello and welcome back to another edition of GamesAtWork.biz, one after a bit of a hiatus, a break, a little interruption in the flu. But Michael and Michael are back with you again and delighted to do so. So, hey, Michael.
Hey, Michael. How's it going?
Very good.
I am very delighted to be back. And, you know, we just asked one quick thing. While you're listening to this show, hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcatcher.
Thank you. And that way you'll make sure that you don't miss any of the shows that we put out there.
Exactly.
Hey, so we have got a fun show for all of you because we've been away for a little bit and we've now figured out a few things that are exciting and interesting to talk about. And we'll start things off with an article from Engadget talking about some new news from Microsoft in the augmented reality space. Some real holographic displays that could fit into your glasses so you're not wearing a pair of ski goggles. And, you know, Michael, when I saw this, I first thought about you, not just because of the augmented reality, of course, but because of the dragon that they used to help demonstrate it.
Exactly. And that was really, really cool. And the thing that I liked about this was the use of software algorithms to dynamically adjust the lasers that they're using to actually offset stigmatism, which I thought was so cool because I know a lot of times, you know, you're at a 3D movie or something, you put the glasses on, and with as a person with astigmatism, it doesn't always work as well as it could, but they're actually working algorithms on the near-eye displays to dynamically adjust for it, which I thought was amazing.
Yeah, I thought that was really super cool too, and it kind of led me down a path that was getting me to think a little bit about how such characteristics might be able to correct for people's poorer vision and give you a better, sharper view that was customized for you.
Exactly, exactly. So not just the really, really cool augmented reality part, but they also were using it to improve the resolution of text so that you could read text, everything that you kind of have with glasses in general, but with the added layer of intelligence and algorithms on top of it to dynamically do things. And it's funny because I'm reading a book right now called Quarantine. It's from early 90s, and there's a lot of human augmentation through software and other implants. And I'm thinking of how they talk about, you know, having the ability to do an infrared overlay in your vision, or, you know, other informational overlays in your vision that doesn't actually show, but your brain interprets the data. And at MoogFest last week, I went to a session on brain-machine interaction. Specifically, they talked about the work that was done for the 2014 World Cup, where they had a quadriplegic actually kick off the first match of the World Cup by coming out and being in a exoskeleton and using a brain interface to actually maneuver and kick the ball. But they were talking about, in this same discussion, how the brain deals with multiple sensory inputs, and they were showing an experiment that they had done with mice and the ability to actually give the mice the capability of seeing in infrared. And so even though mice have no concept of infrared, have no concept of infrared vision, they were able to show a usage of the data coming in this brain interface in infrared to allow the mouse to go to the right food pellet dispenser.
Wow.
And then another thing, they did a thing, an experiment with two monkeys where the combined intelligence of both monkeys would allow them to get to a certain type of juice. And it got me thinking along the lines of the basic idea of a large social network and how crowds behave differently than individuals because the crowd intelligence comes together to a layer of reacting. So to bring it back to the Microsoft story, when we start thinking about all these additional sensory inputs in augmented reality, our brain is malleable enough to accept that data and interpret it in such a way that it becomes just another sensory input and not something that is weird or different. And I'm wondering how that will progress as technology like this progresses.
Wow. That gives me a lot to think about, Michael, and not the least of which deals with things like how people recognize data and data patterns. We've talked about these kind of visualizations before, and I think we've talked a little bit about the ways of not just looking at data in a visual way, but experiencing it through other means too, through auditory means or through others. And you can almost imagine that you could now use a holographic display to really allow for direct interaction with data and data visualizations in a way that might give you the opportunity to peer through it and remix it a little more intelligently.
Yep.
You know? And you need this kind of technology, you know, like what's coming up here to be able to do it. I have to say I've been much more impressed with the HoloLens, and I recognize that this is Microsoft research and more early stuff in the life cycle. You know, the 3D printed glasses are are pretty cool too. It's interesting to see where this is going.
Yeah, and like I said, the fact that the human mind is malleable enough to adjust and deal with that input and turn it into almost a natural input, right, instead of just another data overlay.
Yeah, exactly. And then being also able, have you heard of the concept of a digital twin before?
Yes.
Yeah, so having the chance to essentially peer into something and seeing information about it or its health status or other aspects about it, you know, these are the things that augmented reality is really, you know, well suited to go do. So that digital twin of the data version of an object, having the characteristics of that object but also having the information about it is pretty cool.
Absolutely.
Neat. So, great start to an interesting show from our friends in Redmond. And if we move our gaze, so to speak, for a moment to our friends in Mountain View, came across an interesting couple of tweets today that pointed me toward a Google creation called a Jamboard. And a Jamboard is not related to the French drink.
Or a Jamboard. Jamband.
Or a jam band, or just something that you can have with toast and bread, or butter and bread. What is it? A drink with jam and bread. Anyway, it is a whiteboard, a TV type interface that you're able to draw and erase on in a multiplicity of colors, and you're able to save everything that's on it directly into the cloud. And you're able to interact with the entire suite of Google tools and docs, presentations, everything to draw objects, pictures, video, et cetera, in and out of it to allow for collaboration in a multimodal way. So it's not just the big TV in the front of the room that people can all draw on simultaneously, but it can also be accessed by tablets and phones so that people that are remote from the folks that are in the room can have a similar experience.
Yeah, when you tweeted this out and put it in the show links for us today, it was interesting. For the last year or year and a half, been playing around with the Rico Interactive Whiteboard, which has a lot of the exact same capabilities, the ability to extend it out to tablets on iOS, Android, or Windows, to allow people to stream video, to put overlay, to identify textual shapes and turn them into the actual shapes, the ability to capture the data that's being written to erase, etc. Seems like a very common use case for distributed development teams and other teams.
It does. And when it seems to me, when I'm looking at this, it's not just, a big Microsoft Surface or something that you hang on the wall. I've seen those before. I saw those at Sapphire, I think, last year, and did a lot of talking about that. It's the smarts that are behind it. The interface componentry are really some things like, the eraser and the pens, but that could all be, I think, simulated away one way or another. And you could do this with software in much the same way that the guys at Mural are doing. And, it just struck me right now. Have you done any playing with Mural before, Michael?
Yep. Been using it about a year and with my design team.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Same here. And it's been really nice to have the freedom of essentially a large canvas, and you can put whatever you want on it, text or pictures or, voting and all kinds of other good stuff, nice for retrospectives, easy to put stickies and move them around on there. And I guess if I think about the comparison between Mural and something like a Jamboard or the Rico system that you've just described, it's really the hardware aspect in addition to the software.
Yeah, I think the one thing that's unique about the Jamboard, and obviously it's not unique from the standpoint of who it's from, but the deep integration with the Google Docs suite, which of course it better be, considering who it's from, I do think that the design, the physical design of the hardware is really pleasing. It looks good. The Rico one looked much more industrial, for lack of a better term, and didn't have direct integration with Google Docs, but it has full browser integration for whatever web-based collaboration tool you want to use, whether that's Google Docs or Microsoft Office or Apple Pages or Keynote, right? So I really think the point that you're on the hardware design element and how that is adding another layer above and beyond just the software aspect is the compelling component. Looking price-wise, they're all comparable price-wise. Technical specs, they look to be comparable. It's really which design do you like better?
Yeah, and I'm kind of taking a quick peek here, too. Does the Rico solution also come with a software-as-a-service component to it, too?
I don't know if they require you to subscribe to their software service, but they do have, like you mentioned, the ability to give somebody else access to it in real time who doesn't have the device that's just sitting there with a tablet and they're on the road, right, to connect in remotely.
So here's maybe another linkage to a discussion you had with me over coffee earlier this week. So earlier today, I downloaded the Avatron getairdisplay.com solution.
Yep.
And hooked up via the hardwire connection my iPad to my MacBook.
Yes.
And started enjoying the ability to have a touchscreen, pen-enabled macOS experience.
Yes.
And what if, because there's a little bit of this too, we hooked up such a thing to an iPad-sized TV, or you were kind of doing something along the lines of an Apple TV-enabled structure where a Wacom tablet or pen or something like that could now manipulate what's on the TV.
Yeah.
Could do a little bit of something like that too, couldn't you?
Yeah. Well, that exactly. just think about it. You can take now on a modern Mac device, modern meaning like within the last couple of years, and air display it to your Apple TV on a large screen TV, right?
Right.
You can do that. You can take something like Avatron to then turn your iPad into a giant touchscreen interface to that, even though it wouldn't be on the wall, it'd be in front of you. Mm-hmm. So these collaborative tools where you want to have a large glass canvas, for lack of a better term, where people can jointly collaborate together in a fairly natural pen and paper sort of way is a transition we're going to. And what I'm thinking it will do is actually position us for the next transition, which is now do that with just augmented reality, where we're all looking jointly at a piece of space, right? And seeing it from our perspective and jointly collaborating on something that really isn't there.
And you could do that in a nice augmented reality kind of experience too, couldn't you?
Well, that's my point. As an augmented reality, period.
Right.
Not a virtual reality, no. But an augmented reality. Virtual reality would be the one step removed, which says you and I cannot be in the same space at the same time. So we're going to virtually see each other in the same space. And I think Facebook announced their Facebook Spaces developer preview edition or something like that recently, which gives you that aspect. And then you have the augmented reality of the joint when we're in the same room, seeing the same virtual wall with our stickies on it, right, et cetera, which is the logical extension of going from physically together in a room putting stickies on a wall to physically together in a room putting virtual stickies on a whiteboard to physically together in a room putting virtual stickies on a virtual board to logically together virtually doing work together in a augmented virtual space. How's that?
Gesundheit. No, you're right. So that the riffing here certainly continues. On my flight out to San Francisco earlier this week, I watched the Marvel Doctor Strange movie.
Yeah, I like it.
I liked it too. And we've talked quite a bit about Minority Report for the sort of things that were in that movie, years before. So here you've got the possibility of gesture control to, think about your Magic Leap sort of thing, of doing things with your hands to create objects that you now can manipulate in an augmented reality, holographic enabled joint space where you're physically together, and or astrally project yourself into another space where you've got other people that you can collaborate with at the same time.
Yes.
So technology, magic, indistinguishable one from the other as we continue to move ahead, isn't it?
You got it. I think that's exactly it. And I think that's what's really, really exciting about what's going on right now.
Completely agree. So if we kind of reel ourselves back in from the future and come
to
this.
Let's go back to the future.
We'll go back to the future using the Mr. Fusion. And we use the TechCrunch article as our vehicle, talking about something called Penguin.
Yes.
P-I-N-G, Penguin, as a chat.
A machine that goes ping.
Yes.
It's a very expensive machine that goes ping.
So this was posted in the beginning of May, and it's like, hey, it's a new app that lets you chat with people. And that got me excited already right from the start because, Lord knows, I don't have enough ways to chat.
But focused around your interests, kind of like web forums or IRC or Reddit.
Yes, yes. And you can find rooms and go in there and then talk about things like,
rooms like Sococo.
And dogs and stuff like that.
Yes.
So the article, of course, was pretty funny that there was a room called Podcasts and there was nobody in there. So,
yes, come on down to our room called Podcasts where nobody's
at
either.
We should create a room called Games at Work Club Biz and Penguins to see how many people we can get into that place, right?
Yes.
So I some of the other elements in the article were a bit funny too, but it has some interesting characteristics to it that I originally was using. Oh gosh, what was the Greensboro company Twitterific? The early days of Twitter, do you remember how you could dial back Twitter to tweets that were in a certain mile radius?
Yeah, the geofencing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so this particular article was saying, Twitter didn't really help me that much when I moved from one city to another. Da, 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 da. It's like, well, gosh, it kind of did for me because I would do that. And I had it dialed into a geofenced area around me. So I was limiting the tweets that I was seeing. And you certainly can dial it further based on certain hashtags and other, you know, topic areas, which kind of gets you a little in this penguin space. But this was doing something a little more so you could maybe have that topic around the best chili recipes, regardless of where somebody actually was sitting, and or you could find the best chili recipes that were from Dallas, Texas. So,
well, and this is the thing, right? If you look at any community-based social environment, people will group around specific communities of topics or interests, whether that's a Facebook page or a set of Google
or group
or a Twitter a hashtag or whatever, right? And so I think, you know, if you recognize that up front, maybe Penguin is going down a good path. It certainly allows them to collect much better data and demographic data around specific topics in order to monetize. And you see that with targeted ads within various aspects of social networks like Pinterest, right? Tumblr, right? You kind of know the community that you're getting into. You get a lot of basic demographic information around them. You know the topic. You can do targeted information there. So, you know, Penguin's coming at it from the standpoint of, I think I have a way of monetization of a social network. Let me just start it from that point instead of social networks like Google Plus or Twitter, where it's like, we're going to just let anybody say anything in any group, and then we'll mine that data and try to then come up with a monetization strategy.
I see. Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, but then again, this is the only time I've heard of Penguin, right? And it's been, what, couple of weeks, I've seen nothing else about them.
Well, you know, we're back again to where's the crowd and where are they going?
They're over here. You know why? It's because Penguin is still beta.
Yeah. Yep. And just reading through the comments of this TechCrunch article, it seemed like it was having actually some challenges too, where you couldn't post for at least for a little bit. And that has been resolved. So obviously the developers are working, you know, very hard on this, and they're very tuned into anytime there's a mention around it, which is cool too, because that's how you get social, cred and people paying attention. But it's a very, very early days yet. Yeah.
Yep. I'll probably check it out and download the app.
See if I can get into beta. Shot too.
And maybe we can set up a gamesatwork.biz Penguin area.
Absolutely.
We can do that.
So let's
do that right now.
You guys, come join us then. Yeah, we'll put the show on pause.
And we're back.
And now we're back. So Michael, there's a funny article you'd shared with me about what was going on with the FCC.
Yes. Yeah, so this is for people who have been living in a cave and did not recognize the activities going on between last year and this year's head of the FCC. There's been a double shift of direction. So last year, there was a desire to start having the FCC regulate ISPs and other under Title II, I believe it was called, which means they would treat ISPs as a public utility. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it kind of continues to regulate the ISPs as a dumb pipe. Right. Based off of that, when that was started or attempted to start, there was a lot of commentary on the FCC site because the head of the FCC at the time was thought to have been a huge opponent of net neutrality based off of a concerted effort of podcasters, social media people, and others. A huge bouquet of comments were posted against the proposed regulation, and in October of last year, the FCC decided that they would start treating ISPs as a Title II regulated industry, and that would come into effect sometime this year. I believe it was supposed to be March or April.
Right.
New administration comes in play. Head of the FCC is changed. Once again, it's somebody who is perceived as being anti-net neutrality. And the first thing he does is stop the implementation of the shift to Title II. And a couple of weeks back, or a month or so ago, he started to put the process in place for public comment on permanently rolling that back and allowing ISPs to have the same capabilities that they had prior to the change of last October, which they had not done much with because of public outcry. The belief is with the new FCC head in and the new direction that ISPs become more and more editors of content as well as have the ability to influence what access people have to content through things such as zero rating. And zero rating is a policy where for certain data on your data plan, you do not get charged for the use of that data, thereby making it free or zero cost or zero rated. Yep. However, that gives the ISP editorial control to decide what data does or does not meet that. And the argument against zero rating is it then allows ISPs to regulate on their own who are the winners and losers of innovation. For example, if I have a streaming video service that is part of my corporate umbrella, I may not zero rate Netflix in order to allow my streaming video content to be more accessible to more of my customers than Netflix, i.e., thereby choosing the winner to be my streaming video and not Flix, not Netflix. So that's the basic idea of what's going on. And so John Oliver recently published his weekend news show and put together a link to the FCC website that allows you to comment on the proposed regulation. That link was gofccyourself.com. Obviously, based off of that name, you know his opinion. Now, if you've gone to the FCC site and you're looking for the regulation to comment on, it's really hard to find. So this allowed you to very quickly get there. Well, as soon as it went live, a couple of things happened. A lot of people used the Go FCC Yourself site to start doing comments based off of social media and podcasters and others saying, please go there and don't allow this rollback to occur. As well as, and this is the tweet that you're talking about, a bot was discovered to be posting on the FCC site in favor of the rollback,
right,
and flooding the site with duplicate comments and obviously almost like a address book lookup of names posting these comments to say, oh, roll it back, roll it back. We want it to no longer be considered a Type 2 regulatory environment, blah, 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 blah. So the FCC had temporarily suspended the site to allow you to comment on this regulation change. I checked today, and today the site is back up. But it's funny because the belief that someone is actually going to read all the comments is probably highly unlikely. And if you can point to a bunch of bad posts hitting the site as the reason not to accept public commentary, then you don't have to get public commentary on whether or not this regulatory change should happen or not. And back to the first FCC chairman who changed his mind, the belief was that the large outcry of public commentary against the regulation got him to change his mind is what changed his mind. So interesting to see this play out. If you do have a comment that you want to make on this, as a small podcaster ourselves, I would like to be able to have anybody get access to our podcast and not have it be filtered by some company that decides that their podcasts are better than ours. But I leave it up to you to put your commentary at gofccyourself.com.
And again, that particular website actually resolves directly into the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission's site, where you can go and write what you feel.
Absolutely.
And the funny thing about this, too, is that it's showing, as of our recording, 2,784,000 and change comments. So to Michael's point, if it's shown that several thousand comments are made by not real people, right?
So over 128,000.
Yeah. So a bot has somehow managed to harvest people's names, their phone numbers, their addresses, and use that as the input for what appears to be a valid comment, but the same text is used for each of them. You know, that ought to be a clean, clear thing to say, well, if there's 100,000 of those using exactly the same language and exactly the same words, and the article itself spells out that they tried to contact those people, at least some of them, and the ones that they did get a response from either through the phone or through Facebook Messenger or elsewhere said, nope, never commented on anything. You would think, Michael, that you'd be able to put all those in a bucket and either say, well, these can't be valid because they all have the same characteristics around it, and not throw out the remaining bunch. I mean, you have, especially just a cursory glance myself, is I'm seeing lots of different language and lots of different, ways of describing the opposition to this particular proposal.
Yeah, so, and it's funny because the spam bots look like they all hit at May 11th, all within like an hour. Oop, did I lose you?
No, you didn't. I'm just bouncing through a little bit of this here, and you know, there's 8 pages so far that I'm just kind of seeing. I'm doing now, you know, 100 at a clip here of things that have come in some cases as recently as, you know, still today. And yep, there's a lot that are coming in. So really, really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So if you have an opinion on this, I highly recommend that you go voice your opinion.
Yep. Okay. So let's round out our show for today with an article that you found off of slashfilm.com, which actually is an appropriate website for this particular title, to say there's 20 horror movies that should have been video games.
Well,
and yeah, in our pre-show, I gave you the opinion that I have, or my, I don't know, my preferences. And I don't go watching horror films really at all. So not my cup of tea.
Well, and I'm not a huge fan of horror films,
right?
Yeah. I mean, some of the films in this list I would not consider horror films, like the film back in 1999, The Mummy. Mm-hmm. To me, that was an action-adventure film, right? Kind of like a Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah, there was a big bad guy that, you know, sucked up sand and threw out the curses of ancient Egypt, but it was a fun movie. But what I thought was really cool about this post was really how they took each of these movies and dissected the essence of the movie and used that to define an appropriate game that could be made off of that movie. And so let me just give you one as an example. There's a horror movie called Cube. I never watched it. 1997, Vincenzo Natila's low-budget horror flick, where basically a group of strangers wake up in a bunch of rooms in this house, and each room is color-coded, and they have to figure out the hidden booby traps in order to get out. Okay?
Okay.
So, basically, it is a puzzle game. That's all it is. So you start the pitch for how this could be a great game is you start with a single character with a narrow skill set. You explore the cube that you're in. You find out other survivors, each with their own specific skills. The more people you have on your team, the more prepared you will be to suss out various traps and stay alive. However, different character combinations will cause strife and other issues amongst your team. So basically, puzzle game where you've got to figure out the right mix of the right people in the right room to solve the puzzle. Pretty cool game.
You could help me with that.
Yeah. The Faculty. So this is a movie with Jon Stewart and the guy from The Hobbit. Basic movie match. Mismatched group of teens discover that their school is being taken over by aliens and they must band together to stop the invasion. Okay, I think I saw it on Comedy Central. So again, is it a horror flick? No, it's a funny horror flick. So basically, this one would be all about character interaction, stealth tactics, and decision making. So it would be a game that allowed you to have multiple outcomes based off of branching. Kind of sounds fun. Right?
Kind of does, like
the Zork adventures, except more complex. And so I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, what kind of movies that you and I both like would make a good movie? Sorry, make a good game, and what would that game be like?
Ooh. Okay.
So think of a movie. So,
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
That was Captain Nemo, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And wasn't there like a giant kraken?
Yes, that got released.
And they had to fight the kraken, so it's a travel adventure?
Yes, and you kind of need to do all kinds of fun and interesting things to get yourself
out of the trap. And then not just out of the trap, but also to navigate across the high seas.
So that seems like, another simple game, right? You would have a set of puzzles. Those would be the traps. You could do it as a side scroller. Think of 80s arcade games where you have a side scroller like Ghosts and Goblins, where some of the side-scrolling rooms would be puzzle rooms and other ones would be little combat rooms. And then it would have a boss at the end, the Kraken.
Right.
Right. Cool. Yeah, I guess it is. What about you? Do you have one?
Yeah, I was trying to think of a good movie. So what movie have I watched recently that would make a good game? Watched too many Marvel superhero movies, so that wouldn't work.
Yeah, because there's no games with Marvel superheroes.
I know. It's like, yeah, that wouldn't work. I'm trying to think of a movie that we watched recently that would be a good game. Hidden Figures was a good movie. I can't think of a game there. Just because it was real life, good drama.
Well, sure, you could do some coding. You know, you gotta get that System 390 to work.
Yeah, I think the story was too rich. I mean, I'm trying to think of a good one that would be interesting. How about The Blacklist TV show?
Oh.
So, do you ever watch that?
No.
So basically, James Spader is a guy who runs a big organized crime thing and spies and stuff, and he turns himself into the FBI to turn over bad guys in order to protect this one FBI profiler. basically Monster of the Week movie or TV show. Okay. Mm-hmm. So each week there's an episode and there's some bad guy who's going to be turned in and there's twists and turns. So that could be an episodic game with each level being a, I hate to use the word puzzle. You could do it as an open world game, kind of like Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, sure.
Right? Because in Grand Theft Auto, you pick up different missions. So they would be mission based, and the mission would be, you know, bring in the Undertaker, take out the cleaner, right? And then along the line, you would unearth a larger storyline that progresses your character.
Right.
So that would work.
All right. Well, I guess it would.
So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah. It'd be interesting for our listeners to come up with what's their favorite movie out right now or that they've seen in the last year, and how could they turn that one into a game?
Well, if you have an idea, you could tweet it to us. You could go to our website and comment on the show, or you could use smoke signals or maybe even join us in Penguin and tell us what your movie would be and why it would be a great game.
Excellent. I think that's all we have time for this week, and really great to hear from people while we were off the air, and we will be right back as the next episode in the feed.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Hope you have a great holiday weekend, Michael, and I'm wishing all of our listeners, both in the U.S. and around the world, that we hope you're liking the show, that you can give us your comments and your thoughts. If there's some other things you'd like to hear us expound on or give us an opinion on, we'd love to hear from you at all the usual channels. So, looking forward to the next time.
Absolutely.
And until then, we'll see you later.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.